All right, we would like to call up our friends to read some more from Charles Frazier's novel. Is that ready? Here they are.
Give it up for the readers. Come on. Give it up. Make some noise. It's hard to get up here and read in front of people.
Thank you, sir. I'm going to read a bit about the cabbage harvest. Together they unloaded the sacks beside the smokehouse, and while Ruby put the horse away, Ada went to the kitchen and made another plate the like of her own dinner. Then Ruby ate, talking all the while of cabbages and the many things they would make from them, which to Ada seemed few indeed. Kraut, fried cabbage, boiled cabbage, stuffed cabbage, slaw. When Ruby had eaten, they went to the sacks. One they held back for making into sauerkraut when the signs came around right for it again. Do it otherwise, and it might rot in the crocks. The rest they buried for the winter. It was to Ada an odd and troubling job, digging the grave-like trench behind the smokehouse and lining it with straw and heaping the pale heads in and covering them with more straw and then dirt. When they were done mounding up the dirt, Ruby marked the place with a plank, beating at it with the heel of her shovel until it stood like a tombstone. There, Ruby said, that might save us to scratch around in the snow come January. All Ada could think was how grim it would be on some cloudy midwinter afternoon, wind blowing, bare trees heaving, the ground covered in a gray crust of old snow, to come out and dig into that barrow pit for a mere cabbage.
I'm going to read a section that means a great deal to me. It's about our need to care for one another in our times of greatest grief, and also to care for one another even when we're strangers. This is a point in the book where Inman, the main character, the soldier who's working his way home through the mountains, comes upon a woman who has just lost her child. The men from her life are gone, killed in the Civil War. She has no one to bury her child, and Inman does it for her. They buried her on a nearby knoll where lay four old graves marked with scratched flats of river shale. The first three were infants, birth dates lacking a month of being a year apart, death dates falling mere days after birth. The fourth grave was the mother, and Inman noted she had died on the birth date of the last child. He did quick sums in his head and saw that she lived only to 20. Inman dug the hole for the new grave at the end of the little row of stones, and when he was done, he said, "Do you want to say something?" "No," the woman said. "Every word in me would come out bitter." By the time Inman refilled the hole, dark was coming on. He and the woman went back to the house. She said, "I ought to feed you, but I haven't got it in me to even light a fire, much less cook a meal." She went inside and came back with provisions, two little cloth bundles, one of corn grits and the other of flour, a chunk of lard tied in paper dark with grease, a brown piece of smoke-cured hog neck bone, some parched corn, about a cup of soup beans twisted in a square of paper, a leek and a turnip and three carrots, a bar of lye soap. Inman took them and thanked the woman and turned to walk away. But before he reached the fence gate, the woman called to him. I can't ever look back on this day with a still mind if I let you go without cooking for you," she said. So Inman kindled up a fire, and the woman sat on a low hearth stool and fried him a great beefsteak from a neighbor's heifer that he admired in a slow and died before anyone noticed it missing. The woman filled a brown crockery plate with yellow corn grits cooked thin so they ran to the edges, the steak cupped up in the frying like a hand held out for change. And she put it atop the grits with the cup side down and then mounted a pair of fried eggs atop the dome of meat. And as final garnish, she scooped a plug of butter as big as a squirrel's head onto the eggs. When she set it on the table in front of Inman, he looked down on the plate and he nearly cried as he watched the butter melt across the egg yolks and the whites and the brown meat and the yellow grits until the whole plate glistened in the taper light. He sat with knife and fork fisted up before him, but he could not eat. The food seemed to require some special thanks to be returned, and he could not find the words. Outside, in the dark, a bobwhite called and waited for an answer, and then called again, and a small wind rose, and there was a momentary rain that rattled the leaves and the roof shakes, and then it stopped. "This meal needs a blessing," Inman said. "Say one then," the woman said. Inman thought a minute and said, "I can't call one up. For what I am about to receive, I am thankful." "That's one," she said.
Well, that sure is beautiful. And the author of this book, who's from not too far from here, he's got a real knack for writing about a lot of stuff. He also really captured the essence of the tradition, this old-time music, in this book. And I want to read you just one passage. And then we're going to play the song that it refers to. It says, "The fire threw patterns of light and shadow on the pitched roof stone, and Ada found that if she watched long enough, the fire would form the shapes of things in the world. A bird, a bear, a snake, a fox, or perhaps it was a wolf. The fire seemed to have no interests other than animals. The pictures put Ada in mind of a song, one of Stabrad's. It had particularly stuck in her mind. She had noted it for the oddity of its lyric and for Stabrad's singing, which had been of an intensity that Ada could only assume represented deep personal expression. It took its subject, the imagined behavior of its speaker, what he would do had he the power to become one of a variety of brute creature. A lizard in the spring, hear his darling sing. A bird with wings to fly, go back to his darling, weep and moan till he dies. A mole in the ground, root a mountain down." Ada worried over the song. The animals seemed wonderful and horrible in their desires, especially the mole, a little powerless hermit blind thing propelled by lonesomeness and resentment to bring the world falling around him. More wonderful and horrible still was the human voice speaking the song's words, wishing away its humanity to ease the pain inflicted by lost love, love betrayed, love left unexpressed, wasted love. Ada could hear in Ruby's breathing that she was yet awake, and so she said, "Do you remember that song of your father's about the mole in the ground?" Ruby said that she did, and Ada asked if Ruby thought Stabrad had written the song. Ruby said there were many songs, you could not say anybody in particular, made by himself. A song went around from fiddler to fiddler, and each one added something and took something away, so that in time the song became a different thing from what it had been, barely recognizable in either tune or lyric. But you could not say the song had been improved, for as was true of all human effort, there was never advancement. Everything added meant something lost. And about as often as not, the thing lost was preferable to the thing gained, so that over time we'd be lucky if we just broke even. Any thought otherwise was empty pride.
Yeah.
Thank you. So here's that song that she was singing about, Mole in the Ground. Mm-hmm.